We should be live momentarily. I think we're live probably now. It still says setting up. Here we go. All right. Good afternoon, everybody. It is Angie Atkinson, and I am here with the lovely and talented Dana Morningstar for our usual Tuesday afternoon stream, although I admit we are a little late and it's totally my fault. Today, we thought we would talk about, I found an article on Psychology Today that talks about the idea that are we as people who have been affected by narcissists, are we being judgmental of people who have narcissistic personality disorder or at least traits of narcissism when we talk about how they behave and how we should walk away from them and all of this stuff. And the author says something like, there's one sentence that really amuses me, but I'm going to read you a couple. Basically, in the most extreme cases, we harshly judge and condemn people who struggle with narcissism. They are portrayed as inhuman, evil, malignant, and beyond redemption. And it's very tempting to indulge in that portrayal, he says. And then he says, and while this assessment is understandable and may be a necessary part of evolution of the evolving discussion on narcissism, it could be, he says, ultimately more harmful than helpful to anyone involved. He says, in a sense, we are showing a lack of empathy toward people we accuse of lacking in empathy. And then he goes on to talk about how basically we're being judgmental when we talk about narcissists and their behaviors. So the question today is then, does our recognition of the narcissist's lack of empathy mean that we too lack empathy? I'm not trying to laugh at that, but and I know that sometimes it probably does to us. It probably does sound like, not to us, but to other people, that we are, in fact, lacking empathy. Wait a minute. I totally forgot to do all the thing about the beginning, but sorry. Okay. Let me say this really quickly, everybody. This is Dana Morningstar with me today, who is with me every Tuesday, either here or over on her channel, Thrive After Abuse. And you can find her all around the internet at thriveafterabuse.com or Thrive After Abuse. All right. Hello, Candace Jackson, and welcome. I am happy to have you here with us as a new Spanily member. Okay. So, Dana, what do you think about this idea that we are not being empathetic when we are talking about the abuse and the drama and the behaviors of the narcissist?
Oh boy, that's such a big question. And there's so many different ways I think one could approach it.
Yes.
I guess first and foremost, where to even begin with that? Do I think it's lacking empathy if we recognize someone else's lack of empathy? Just recognizing a lack of empathy doesn't mean that we lack empathy.
Right.
Condemning another person for lacking empathy to some degree does show a lack of empathy, but I think there's been so, and here's the other thing too. I don't know this, who wrote this article. I don't know their background. Even if they are a mental health professional, it sounds to me that they've never been on the receiving end of extreme narcissism, like pathological narcissism. And that's what our channels talk about. It's not narcissism as in, oh, that's obnoxious. Right. It's in that's destructive, that's deadly, that's dangerous. And the amount of damage that pathological narcissism does, it spans generations. Like yes. It's a big deal. It's not just, oh, this person's a self-absorbed jerk.
Right.
So what I kind of have to, I don't know. It doesn't even really make me question if the person's ever been on the receiving end of it, because just by the tone of the article, to me, that says, no, they haven't.
I mean, absolutely. Right?
Yeah. I guess for those people that do write articles like this, whatever their background may be, I would encourage them to do some introspection and to replace the word narcissist with something that's more maybe pathologically understood, like a child abuser or a murderer or a rapist or somebody else that's acting from with extreme antisocial behavior and a pathological degree of narcissism. You would never in a million years go to a place where, I don't know, adults or children that have been sexually abused who are now in a support group. You would never go to them, even if they were adults, and say, oh, you need to have empathy for those that have hurt you. And
That's right.
that's how it comes across to those that have been deeply wounded by pathological narcissism in any form. It's just, it's an, a, I can see where he's coming from, but I think it's a really controversial point, and it's something that really needs to be treaded upon lightly. And I think for many survivors of pathological narcissists, it's not only
Insulting.
re-victimizing, it's tone deaf, it's so wildly inappropriate. It kind of it sets the it's this other another form of controlling behavior of, oh, I'm telling you how you should heal or how you should process your pain. And that just inherently bothers me so much because obviously this person does not know what they're talking about from being on the receiving end of it. And that just makes me want to smash things.
Yes, I agree. With that being said, I want to say this, two things. First, Joe Sauter, even though you've been in this family for a long time, thank you for joining again. And Richard Dobbins makes a point that I thought I would touch on. He says, I think that we label way too many people narcissists. I think a lot of codependents are labeled that when they are not. And I think up to a point, that's true. And what I mean by that is that we all know how many narcissists call other people narcissists. And there are so many situations where, you know, obviously none of us are here to diagnose anybody. But what it comes down to is that this particular personality disorder and the things that characterize it are pretty recognizable to people who are in the middle of it, dealing with someone who's abusing them as a result of their own personality issues. With that being said, I don't think, as I've said repeatedly, I don't think the label is so important as is the impact that person has on your life and in your on your space, you know, your energy, and everything. I absolutely agree with what you said about it being, you know, a tone deaf article. And you know, just a minute ago, I was kind of scrolling back through of it. Excuse me, back through it, and I was reading and talking at the same time. And you know, they talk about the article is written by a PhD, of course, Michael Friedman. And I think, okay, I'm not going to make any judgment based on his photograph and tell you that I think maybe he's one of them. I wouldn't do that because that's judgmental. And I really don't know that man at all, so I can't talk about him. But he does mention a certain politician, and I suspect he is on that particular politician's side, and that could be part of what he's doing here. But basically, he points out, you know, people with narcissism can suffer greatly, and the grandiosity and defensiveness that many people employ, you know, blah blah blah. He talks about they have depression and anxiety and all this substance dependence. But what he doesn't talk about is he talks a little bit. He says our fascination with narcissism is understandable because of the impact they have on the people around them. And then he talks about how they're toxic in relationships and how annoying they can be. But he doesn't really go into any detail about abuse and, you know, emotional, psychological abuse or any of that. And I think those people, I have always said, and I think that you're on the same page with me here. I think that, you know, when we are talking about a toxic narcissist or just a toxic person, we're not talking about somebody who is self, you know, just self-focused. We're not talking about somebody who is into taking selfies or who, you know, cares about how they look or who is even kind of full of themselves, because sometimes full of yourself can really be self-esteem, right? But I think what we're talking about, at least when I'm talking about it, and I think you are as well, we're talking about someone who is pathological, somebody who lacks empathy. I think that lacking empathy on a pathological level is the ultimate definition or the uniting quality of all of these toxic people, regardless of diagnosis or not, you know. And what do you think? And you seem like you're about to say
Oh,
something.
yeah, I was going to add to that, you know, and it's not even a lack of empathy that's the problem. It's Because you could even say, okay, there's some people on the autism spectrum that kind of lack empathy.
That's true.
Okay, it's more of the entitlement and the justification and the cruel and callous mistreatment of others that goes along or that precedes the lack of empathy. So they feel entitled and justified to just to treat other people in whatever way they see fit. That's the problem.
Right.
You know, like we would never come down on somebody else who has a lack of empathy due to a brain injury or, you know, a cognitive disorder of any kind if their behavior is not malicious and intentional. I think,
100%. That's right. They lack it and they act like they lack it. Because I think, and I could be wrong, but what I've heard from people, some people who are actually on the autism spectrum, is that they do feel for you, but they can't always express that out loud or in their externally. You know what I mean? Like they might on the inside be hurting, but they're not always able to express it physically or verbally. Do you know what I mean? Or not just hurting, but they might feel for you on some level, some of them in some cases. I think it obviously depends on the type of autism and the degree to which it has affected them. But I don't think that, in fact, I know that I wouldn't put people who are autistic on that scale at all, personally, on the narcissism spectrum.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't either. I mean,
Right.
I think it's,
I
I
think, in
guess the
fact,
overlap is kind of behavior that comes across that can come across as lacking empathy or
you're right. I see
more
it.
kind of like socially tone deaf type
Yes,
of thing. I
that's
mean,
it. But that also can make them a victim, in my opinion.
oh, 100%.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Because they miss those little subtle things that, and I think we probably have several. I know at least a few of the people here in our community. I want to say, and I don't want to say any names because I don't want to assume, but or I don't want to out anyone who doesn't want to be outed, but I know a couple of people who are moderators on your channel, I believe are on the spectrum from what they've told me. Anyway, okay. So, yeah.
It's go ahead, sorry.
I just want to really quickly, Joe Sauter commented and said, thanks. He just went and signed back up for Spanily and had to update a credit card due to a post-divorce new one. We love you too, Joe. Okay, go on. Didn't want to miss that super chat.
Yes,
What were
yes.
we going to say?
Oh, I forget what I was going to say, but I found a comment
Oh,
in the
okay.
chat. This is from Luna, who says, I'm so glad this is being discussed because I've been feeling this way since joining. I feel bad for talking bad about someone who treats me bad. Who
Yeah.
is bad? LOL. Confusing.
It is. And I think the difference here, and I think something that we all have to recognize is that although, you know, I have talked many times about the best revenge about narcissists and what it all comes down to, in case you haven't seen those videos, is the best revenge is always living well without them, right? I never, and I don't think you ever would advise that you should hurt them in any way, physically or mentally or otherwise. Just get away. And if that hurts them, that's separate from you because you have been abused by them. You know, I mean, would they ask you to stand in a room that was on fire just so it didn't hurt anybody's feeling? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like staying in a relationship with a toxic person just so that you're not, you know, being them, being like them, or being judgmental, or being, you know, with lacking empathy. That I almost feel like that's a form of gaslighting for that person to even write that article, now that I think about it. I'm not saying he said to stay in the relationship, but I'm just saying, is it not to minimize the experiences of abused people? Is it not on that gaslighting scale somewhere? Am I off base here, Dana? Help me out.
Yeah,
I
I
don't
have
think.
to read his article, but I, you know, I
Yeah.
think there's a lot of thoughts I have about this. There, you know, there's nothing wrong with making an observation
True.
about somebody's behavior. It's important that we do that. There's a difference between being judgmental and being discerning and being full aware of this person lacks empathy. They are not sincerely apologetic for what they do. They don't care how their behavior hurts other people. It's very important that we see that for what it is. To acknowledge that is not in it's has nothing to do with us lacking empathy. That's us, you know, using common sense and critical thinking,
Yeah.
where it's can be lacking empathy is, treating them kind of an inability to put ourselves in their shoes and to see where kind of they're coming from. Yes, they do have issues, and you know, a lot of which are of their own doing, and it is tragic.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, especially from where we come from, with working with so many survivors of narcissistic abuse, you know, my main priority is getting people to make themselves a priority in their own life.
Yes.
And to realize that they matter and that they have value, and kind of focusing the narrative all, oh, we need to be more compassionate for those who hurt you, is incredibly damaging, because
yeah.
those are messages that are already, and that can come down the road, right?
Yes.
After at a certain place in healing, we can understand the damage that we incurred at from this other person is because we were interacting with their limitations and
yep.
didn't realize it. We were operating from the mindset of, well, everybody's inherently all the same, right? And if we treat other people well, then they'll treat us well. And
right.
we didn't realize that the kind of the map of the world that we were given was grossly inaccurate. So there's a lot of kind of reconfiguring these messages that we've picked up. And Luna's comment about, I feel bad about mentioning that somebody's bad who's treated me bad, kind of a thing. This goes back to early childhood programming, where so many of us are taught, actually not even so many, I've yet to find somebody that wasn't taught this. It's the whole thing of, oh, you don't want to, don't, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
That's right.
Or you're not perfect either. Or we all make mistakes, or forgive and forget, or,
right.
You know, you need to quit blaming others and be accountable. And this is an absolute glue trap for
yes.
people who are struggling with moving forward, because it's been so hammered into us to not blame other people, to take on full accountability.
Yeah.
And there's times where, and a lot of times, what's really important, especially in healing, to go back through and assign appropriate accountability to the actions. If your parents were abusive of any way, shape, or form, it's important that we're able to acknowledge that and assign appropriate accountability. They let you down. They should not have done this. They were supposed to be your provider and your protector, and they didn't. And you're upset and you're hurt, and you have every right to be, you know, because they
Absolutely.
Dropped the ball.
Absolutely.
And kind of parsing out accountability for who's accountable for what, doesn't mean that we're somehow shirking blame, or it doesn't mean that we're done with the healing process. It just means, okay, now we're kind of divvying up who's responsible for what, so then we can get clear on what the next steps are, who needs to take the actions to do the work, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that the other thing we have to pay attention to is the fact that I think most of us, before we recognized that we were with a toxic person, we really thought we were the problem in many cases.
Yeah.
And I personally spent so much time like reading self-help books and trying to change myself to better tolerate that person. And in fact, anytime you see a toxic relationship that is working, it's because it's first of all not really working, but it's because the person who is the victim, and I hate to use the word victim, but it is what it is in this case. The person who is being abused in that relationship is inevitably, they have figured out how to sort of maneuver. That's what I did for a long time. I tried to figure out, okay, well, if I always agree with them, and if I never criticize them, and if I always, you know, it works, but you'll go insane without being seen, and because you won't be seen or heard as an individual person, you know, you will essentially be becoming narcissistic supply on purpose, you know,
yeah.
constantly lifting them up, always ignoring yourself and your own needs, you know, as far as they know. And so my point is, I think that this is why I think it's so harmful. This, on top of everything that you said, because the people that narcissists choose are inevitably people who have been treated not always, but most times, have some sort of trauma in their childhood, right? That they carried through with them. On, you know, a lot of times, like you said, it's a abusive parents, or it's in some cases, you know, there are abandonment issues around it. But we don't need to go into all that today. The point is, most people who end up with a narcissist have had trauma in the past and are being actively re-traumatized in the relationship, whether we're talking about just emotional and psychological stuff or more. By telling us that we're not lacking empathy, or we're being judgmental by saying this person abused me or this, and I don't think that's what he was saying, but that's how it felt reading it, right? So I think you're putting people in a box that they shouldn't be put in. Does that make sense? Yeah. So let's see what we've got. Richard Dobbins says narcissists only pretend to care when you can give them something. They also mirror you, so it's hard to see sometimes. Valid point. Tammy says my mom's a covert narcissist, would never display any signs to others of the lack of empathy she has for me as the outcast child and the pleasure she has in my pain. And I think this is another valid point, is that obviously, like you mentioned, this person probably hasn't been on the receiving end of a at least a close relationship with someone like this. And so they don't know this pain. You know, they don't know how it feels to be the only one who knows you're being abused, except for your abuser, right? I mean, that really happens. And I mean, a lot of times in families, even it's minimized, like the one parent who's doing the, and I'm again referring back to childhood, the one parent who does the abusing, the other parent kind of covers up for them. And, you know, it becomes this little secret, ugly family secret that nobody should have. You know, it's, yeah.
I agree. That's
Yep.
how that goes. And a lot of that minimization, you know, comes into play. Oh, they had a bad childhood, they had a bad day, they're a recovering alcoholic, they are an alcoholic, it's this, it's that, you know, it's always an excuse. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It
That's
doesn't
right.
matter. We, you know, none of us are responsible for what happened to us. The vast majority of people on this planet go through trauma before the age of 18, significant trauma, and we're not responsible for it, but we are responsible for our healing. And at a minimum, where we're still responsible by law, right? There's a certain understanding of what the basics of appropriate adult behavior is.
Right.
We expect that regardless. You wouldn't go into a job and be like, oh, well, you know, they had a bad day. That's why they, you know, threw hot coffee in the client's face, or though they had a bad childhood, and that's why they, you know, shredded all the paperwork and walked out of the meeting. Like, nobody cares.
Right. And
It's
on top of that, they're not considering the fact that most of us have had some kind of bad day or bad childhood too. You know,
right.
I mean, you know, that's what I'm always thinking, like how I do. I look, I'm going to just tell you straight up, and I've said so in many videos, I do have compassion for people who are affected in this way. However, that doesn't mean I have to let them be in my life or part of my inner circle. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can, and what I mean is, because I'm somebody who grew up in a situation that wasn't so great in certain ways, I get it if somebody had a bad childhood. I get it if somebody had bad things in their lives. And I do have compassion, but I also still care about how other people feel and act like I care how other people feel. And that's, you know, so no, I'm not going to, just because I can understand on a logical level and feel bad for what they went through, doesn't mean that I can tolerate or should tolerate or that you should tolerate the behavior of an abuser. But we all kind of think that way at some point in this process. We go, oh, well, they act like that because their dad died or because this happened or that happened when they were a kid or they were in some way abused or whatever. But then again, we're not acting that way. And so there's got to be something there. I want to touch a couple comments from Candy really quick. She pointed to Luna, or she said to Luna, the comment that you mentioned earlier. She said, I know how that feels. I've often been shamed by others for talking badly about the person who hurt me so badly. And I have seen and heard and experienced that same thing myself, especially when it comes to my parental narcissist. Yeah. And, you know, just really quickly, the thing to do there is to not accept that. You don't have to even talk about it to the person that's doing it to you. You could just walk away, but, or you could just say, you don't understand because you weren't there or whatever, but don't ever feel the need to explain yourself to somebody who doesn't want to understand you. Say that. And then Dana, I'm going to ask you for your thoughts on that. But first I want to share the other part of her comment.
Okay.
Where she said, the worst part about what my narcissist has done to me is that I've been afraid to think for myself because I was brainwashed to be afraid of the entire world. And that is so common, right? Mm. It's, I think all of us go through that on some level. And I think sometimes, you know, it's, it lasts longer than we'd like to admit.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I still read 75 reviews before I buy anything. All right, Dana, what are we going to say?
Right. Yeah, that there's so much validity to that, especially if you grew up in a home where there was constant criticism. And there was also kind of balanced with constant pressure of you need to hurry up. You need to do this. You need to do that. You need to hurry up, get a job. Oh, but not that job. Why would you work in that field?
Right.
Oh, you need to graduate from college, but wait, that degree? No, I don't think you should go for that degree. And so it's this, you know, pressure, but then it's every step you take, it's the wrong one.
Right.
And those two things, even if it's just the constant criticism, that undermining really rattles a person's ability in their own decision making and in their own ability to act. And it's the effects of that can really be disastrous, and it can be difficult to move forward from that. I think identifying it for what it is a big part of it. Realizing, oh, okay, you're not lazy. Mm-hmm. You're not super scattered. It's, if there's this fear of moving forward, then it's probably because you encountered a lot of criticism.
Yeah.
And to kind of explore that, and then to explore, okay, well, what are we looking at worst case scenario? You know, how can we move forward an inch at a time? You know, how can you move forward in ways that are comfortable? And, you know, who else can you ask for help? And can you get a mentor? Can you get a support system in place? And like, what are the tools at your disposal to help you move forward? Yeah, there are lots of scary things out in the world, but at the same time, I think it helps to kind of think about, okay, well, how am I going to handle that? You know, some things, and everybody's different on this, like some risks are certain people are willing to take, others not so much, you know, and that's okay. It's just where you, like, for example, I have a friend, female friend of mine, who travels all over the world by herself. And that does not appeal to me at all in multiple ways, but safety wise, I would never do that. And I'm okay with that. So like, you know, that's not something that I feel like I want to work through, because I'm totally okay with my decision. Whereas other people are absolutely terrified of majoring in the wrong thing in college or choosing the wrong career field, these kinds of things, figuring out, okay, how can you move forward and be comfortable with the decisions you make so you can be comfortable with the consequences of your actions. And then realizing we all make mistakes, and success doesn't happen due to our lack of mistakes. It happens due to all of the mistakes we make and continuing to move forward and learning from them.
100%. I could not agree more. Yeah. And I think this is, this is important stuff. Yeah. In fact, I think you kind of just answered a question I just saw in the chat. Well, my cat is over here and he there's cat hair everywhere. Okay. It's like flying through the air. Yeah. Kiss Kiss says, how do I stop blaming myself after narcissistic abuse? And you kind of touched on that there. I mean, really, that's the process. But then I'm sorry, we've got some really great comments. Then Kiss Kiss goes on to say, my narcissist ex made me crazy, While dating, if I pointed out the lies, I found out they were all true after we broke up, and this made me doubt our 2-year relationship, and I can't stop crying. So I want to come back to that, but I want to add Luna's comment, the which I think is relevant. Luna says, really, the bottom line is, unless I'm willing to truly acknowledge the abuse and speak out about it out loud, then it will be almost impossible to move forward. And I think that for a lot of us is the truth. And it's very difficult to even speak about it, even now for me, not to mention, I mean, obviously I'm used to it up to a point, but I certainly, there are certain things I still haven't talked about and probably never will publicly, that happened to me back then. So I get it. But yeah, the kiss kiss comment, kiss kiss is a cute name, by the way. The part about the ex making them crazy, if the lies were pointed out, and after breaking up, found out they were all true, this made me doubt our 2-year relationship. And this is the thing that I think a lot of us go through. I won't, I'll make this fast, but I think I hear this from clients all the time. I hear it from people here on YouTube and then in the private support groups, all the things. And I'm sure you do too, Dana. This exact thing, we go, oh, was my whole life a lie? And the same thing happened to me when I realized my parent was a narcissist. I was like, wait a minute. I thought this was true, but it turns out that was true. And this was when I was like 35, So like, I get it. It really does just make you feel like you're not like everything was not what you thought or not real. And you mourn the illusion sometimes more than the actual person, right? You mourn the idea that you had of them or the person you thought they were. And then when you realize, holy shimoles, they're like pathological and they won't change. They could if they wanted to, I believe, but they generally don't. Never seen it. Then you're spinning. And I think this is a normal part of the process. But I think what I've chosen to do, and I think what maybe is a healthy choice, and Dana, tell me if I'm wrong, is I think I've chosen to take what I could from the experience, learn what I could, and move away from the rest. Like not stay focused and stay like sort of stewing in the aftermath forever. At some point you have to let go and release. You may not be ready yet because it's still just recent, right? But when you're ready, then you'll know and you'll start doing the work that's necessary. And I can go into a lot of that, but I don't think we have su super a lot of time today. So, Tina, what are your thoughts about the being able to stop spinning after, she's saying made me doubt the entire 2 years of the relationship, and I can't stop crying. What are your thoughts on that? The lies and realizing everything wasn't what you thought.
It makes your head spin for
Yes.
sure. And it's a lot. I mean, it takes a while to kind of get your bearings again because, okay, the relationship was 2 years. When you realize that there was so much deceit, your brain, I think it just automatically goes back to square one to try to make sense of things. And it just starts reliving that relationship over again with this new significant piece of information of, oh, that they lied about this and this. And then you start seeing things differently. And it's this constant, not necessarily rehashing, I wouldn't say, of events, but making sense of them. So you're revisiting them. I know I experienced that with my relationship with Jack when everything was a lie, going back through and you're like, oh my God, that makes this certain conversation make sense. And that makes, this, it, you just, everything is different and it just throws you for a loop.
Really does.
And it can be difficult to just kind of let go of, or maybe kind of paring it down and realizing, okay, I'm not going to know the 100% truth about everything. All I know is that it was full of lies and deceit and chaos and craziness, and that's all I need to know.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then just kind of
That's right.
shut the door on it.
And that's a valid point you're bringing up here is the lack of closure, right? And I think that narcissists almost intentionally cause us to not have closure sometimes. Sometimes they're just doing what they do, but that lack of closure is probably a big part of why you feel the way that you feel in this when you're spinning, don't you think?
Oh, 100%. Well, and keep in mind, like, you're dealing with a person who has a deeply dysfunctional mindset and view of the world and coping mechanisms and everything. So it's not, I think it's definitely the exception for those narcissists out there that are so malicious and intentional and devious that they're, plotting behind the scenes of, oh, I'm not going to give them closure. I don't, that, I'm sure that does happen to a small person, for a small percentage of people, but it's more of they want to keep a good thing for them going. And so that's why they're not allowing closure, because then it would mean the ending of whatever they have going. And that's what
And I'm really sorry that I'm about to do this again. Unless you have one, I'm going to bring one up.
Okay,
Do
no,
you have one?
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, this is from Lady Love, who says, yes, I agree that autistic children or adults can be the perfect victim for a narcissist. I have an autistic daughter that visitation with her dad, and there is emotional abuse going on. What should I do?
That is a great question. I think always document everything you can. I would talk to, I don't know if your child has like a counselor or if you're getting a counselor, I think you should consider taking your child to a counselor who's qualified to help in this particular situation. But with that being said, I think for the purpose of custody and visitation, I don't know how old your child is, but because I'm, I have mostly teens at this point. Oh no, two, almost a teen and then a teen and then a 23-year-old. So, those, older kids, you would give them a little more responsibility for documentation purposes, if nothing else. Obviously, give them a phone and have them texting you or whatever. But in any case, I think document what you're told by the child. I would talk to, an attorney or an advocate of some sort, but outside of that, try to teach them some coping skills if because it's very difficult to prove sometimes, especially in a situation where you're dealing with somebody who might not be that great at communicating to people they don't know, for example, what's happening. So I don't know. Dana, what are your thoughts? Maybe you have some better
Yeah,
ideas
no,
here.
I would agree. I think it's important to find a child counselor, somebody who only works with children and who is familiar with abuse. You can a good place to start would be contacting your local domestic violence agency and seeing if they have resources for counselors that are familiar with emotional, verbal, psychological forms of abuse, and get a few names and then call a few. In order to document it for court purposes, you're going to need, it's, I mean, it's good anyhow to have your child seeing a child counselor if, there's a difficult parent involved, especially if there's abuse going on. But they'll be able to act as that unbiased, kind of neutral third party, which is what you want, because if you're going in, to court and saying, yes, my ex is abusing my child, this, that, and the other, like Angie's saying, it can be really difficult to prove. And it can also be, there's a kind of that fine line too between seeing certain things that you're saying is coaching the child. So having that neutral, unbiased third party to assess your child, they can also work on coping mechanisms and ways that she's not. Ways to work on not internalizing the stuff that her father is saying. So, yeah.
Valid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I have this interesting comment from Christy. That says, golden children entitlement more than abuse trauma creates narcissism and society enables them. So I'm going to talk about that. Two things. First of all, I do agree that there are cases where entitlement comes from being completely spoiled rotten growing up, for sure. Most of the time, those are the golden children, absolutely. But in most of those cases, a parent who actively chooses a golden child, whether it stays the same one or it rotates, is inevitably, I think it's really important to acknowledge that while you might have a different relationship with each one of your kids, you you acknowledge their differences in a positive way rather than a negative way, right? And so, for example, if you have one kid who's like, always on the ball, getting good grades, doing all the things, and you have another kid who's maybe from the outside lazier or less motivated, but that kid's also creative in a different way, you can focus on that. My point is, if a parent abuses one child and treats the other child like gold, as we see with scapegoats and golden children, for example, that parent is toxic to that golden child as well. Okay, I was not the golden child, but I can definitely recognize how a golden child would be constantly under pressure, as we all are, right? As we all were, but in a different way. Like, I don't want to disappoint this parent who has put me up on this pedestal. And the idea of being disappointing is painful. And even though that golden child might be getting better treatment than the scapegoat or the other kids, that golden child is still being abused in a different way. Let me say that. And I'm only saying this because I think it's really important to recognize as people who might affect children who might become adults one day, that accountability is important, that, responsibility, all those things, but we must recognize that even if something, even the most spoiled, look, here's an example. So I had a client once, I'm not going to go into too many details, but you probably heard of the family. And the thing is, this person lacked for nothing. They wanted nothing. They had everything and then some, but they didn't have their mother because their mother and their father went traveling all the time and were so busy doing whatever they were doing. They had nannies. And you know what? This was a poor little rich kid. And that sounds messed up, but this child was neglected on a significant level and spent their whole life and became an adult thinking they were not good enough to even get the attention of their mother, who was an okay person, but just neglectful emotionally, right? So you look at that person and you go, well, I grew up in this situation, or that's, I was beaten, I was poor, I was whatever, and how could you say that child was abused? They had everything and then some because they were emotionally neglected. You see, so you can't, I'm just saying it's a very small, I mean, certainly there are children who their parents just try too hard and spoil too much and don't have any need to give them accountability or whatever. And but I don't think those are I think those are the exception rather than the rule when we're talking about a narcissist. I think it's there's inevitably some level of trauma, even in a child that was handed everything five times. You know what I'm saying? Like I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Dana, thoughts?
No, I agree completely. I mean, that's the whole thing, kind of parsing out nature versus nurture and how much each plays into it, into the development of a person and how we handle things. It's such a unique thing. I mean, you can have a dozen people go through the same experience and they come out with a dozen different perspectives. So
And while some trauma might be more obviously painful, and if we're honest, some trauma is probably more significant than other trauma. Who are we to decide who gets to, you know what I mean? Like, we didn't, this is funny. My daughter always tells me, Mom, you can't compare my childhood to your childhood. It's different. And you can't, because I'm always like, well, my mom would have done this, and that's a bad thing to say in my case. But I'm trying to say, look, I'm not being that mean. I'm just making you do your homework or whatever, But it's true that I shouldn't be doing that. I should, and so I acknowledge this. You're right. Totally different situation. My point is, a person who has walked through fire, might feel that walking through a super sweaty room is not that big of a deal, or sitting in one for 6 hours, whereas a person who has only lived in the North Pole might just about melt in that room. And that's a really silly thing to, way to put it. But my point is, it's all relative, right? Isn't it?
Right. Oh, absolutely. And it depends too on the ages a thing happens. If a parents, let's say parents leave a child for whatever reason, let's say it's not even for malicious or mean reasons. There's a horrible accident, and the parents are like, "Oh my gosh!" And they run down the street, right? Because there's an, I don't know, an accident in the street, and their 2-year-old doesn't know where they went, right? That 2-year-old could be traumatized by that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
If the same thing happened when the child was 8, they might be confused. If the same thing happened when the child was 15, that 15-year-old might kind of like a break. Like, oh,
Yeah.
that's so good. Hey, mom and dad aren't here. Oh, this is great.
Woo.
Oh,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's
And
right.
they might not even go looking for him. So there's so many different factors at play. And, the downside to having a person having everything kind of spoon-fed to them is, there is no sincere connection with their parents, which sets them up for, all kinds of attachment issues and challenges later on in life with relationships and low self-esteem and all kinds of issues. And, a person that's been handed everything doesn't learn the skills of struggling and resiliency. And this has been a thing, kind of in the entrepreneurial world that is just kind of becoming more mainstream, of how many people, are graduating from these Ivy League schools and then going on to form a business thinking, oh, they're going to be the next, Mark Zuckerberg or whatever, or Bill Gates, and then not realizing that failure is part of it. And then they fail miserably and then they commit suicide
Oh,
because they
yeah.
don't have, they've never failed before.
That's right.
So there's such a line. I think so much of these skills can be taught and should be taught. And the problems come in because they're not taught. And it's a heck of a learning curve
Yeah.
for a lot of us,
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
I have a comment if you,
Yeah.
this is from Sarah Smiles, and she says, I'm afraid to even talk to my abuser now because he twists it and brings it back at me. I'm pretty depressed.
I get it. And that's exactly what this is, I'm not laughing at that. I'm just, this is exactly why it's so pervasive. It's so hard to recognize because exactly that you become afraid to talk to them and you walk on eggshells. I lived on eggshells for a long time. It is, I'm sorry that you're going through that, first of all. And I think this, I guess my question would be, do you have plans to move away from this person? Do you have plans to change your circumstances? And if not, I would say you're probably doing the right thing by not getting too direct with this person right now, because it's like talking to a brick wall and they won't hear you. They refuse to hear you. Even if you make a valid point that strikes home with them, they'll never tell you. And if they do tell you, it'll be in the form of narcissistic rage or narcissistic injury, as you know by now. So I guess I would just say I'm very sorry that you're going through that, and I hope you'll consider moving forward when and if you're able to. Dana, thoughts?
Yeah, and I guess I would say, do you have to talk to your abuser?
Right.
And if so, why? And then if there's absolutely no way that you can, and I guess I would also encourage you to kind of limit conversations, realizing we don't have to engage. We don't, just because somebody wants to talk to us doesn't mean that we have to talk to them. Just
Right.
because somebody asks you questions doesn't mean that you have to answer. Just because somebody wants to argue about something doesn't mean that you need to indulge them. So if let's say this person is family, for whatever reason, you can't limit contact with them. If you're finding yourself in these situations where they're twisting things and then focusing on you and everything you're doing that's bad and wrong, you can nip that in the bud and say, I don't want to have this discussion anymore. Or like, we're done here. But if a person is, and then I guess the other part of that too is realizing, and this is can be kind of a big aha moment for a lot of people. I know it was for me, of realizing you don't have to keep everybody in your life. Like, if a person is really mean to you, why are they in your life?
I agree.
Like that was such a game changer for me of like, oh, I thought I just needed to keep these people in my life and that they were just difficult and I just needed to learn how to deal with it. It didn't dawn on me for a long time of, oh, I can just spend significantly less time with them. They don't get to decide how much time I spend with them. I decide that. They might want me to come and visit for 3 weeks, but if I can only handle a day and a half, then that's what I'm going to do. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah,
So,
I'm with you. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. We have a couple more comments from Christy,
Okay.
who says they failed to develop empathy when they are lifted up in pride and coached to abuse the scapegoat. And then scapegoats are way more traumatized and usually aren't narcissists, so trauma is not the link. And again, I would say exactly what I already said. I would say that sometimes you don't, especially when you're the scapegoat, you don't see that. And with that being said, let me just say this. Every situation is different. And in your situation, Christy, that may have absolutely been the case. But there are many narcissists who came out of horribly abusive homes and childhoods. And I know for sure that this is true. So I would say, yes, absolutely. Sometimes the golden child becomes the narcissist. Sometimes not. Sometimes it is the scapegoat. But I agree, it's rare for a scapegoat to be a narcissist because they grow up thinking there's nothing good about them. But it happens. It happens because it's the way that I don't know if y'all can hear my son with his freaking tuba out.
No.
Okay, good. Okay, because he's playing. He's practicing his. He's getting ready to do a competition. And so anyway, I guess he forgot I was alive right now. Anyway, it's distracting me. My point is. You can't assume every situation is the same. And I'm telling you, because I talk to a lot of people who deal with this, and I've personally dealt with it myself. Yes, you're making a valid point, I think, on the scapegoats being less likely to be a narcissist, but not always. Many times what happens is they sort of, it really depends on how you, as the abused person, react to the abuse when you're a child. How do you develop from there? Because it could be that, like I did, you turn your love external, sort of, or your whatever, and you start to, okay, I recognize that when I do what this person likes, then my life is better. So I want to do what everybody likes. And you become a people pleaser and you become a codependent and whatever. But sometimes it turns the other way. And instead of turning all of that external, you turn it internal and you start to only care about yourself because you're only. You're one of those people who go, and this is a narcissist, a lot of times turns into what we're calling a narcissist. Somebody who goes, well, nobody helps me, nobody takes care of me, so I'm just gonna only worry about me and not worry about them. I think it has something to do with nurture, but also something to do with nature. And so there's, and the fact that you can have two or three or five kids coming out of the same family, where some will be toxic and some, I mean, if we're being honest. When we're going through the depths of our codependency, when we're in the middle of what I would, that addiction, we're being abused, we're being whatever, we're toxic too at that time. I mean, I hate to be the one to have to say it, but we are. We're toxic to ourselves. And while we're not actively abusing anyone, we are allowing toxicity into our lives. We are toxic at that time until we recognize. Now, I'm not saying we're toxic in the same way that a narcissist is. Instead of, again, instead of ex here where they turn the love and the focus on themselves and we turn it outward, it's the other way with the toxic. We turn the toxic in and they turn it out, right? So I'm just saying, I'm not saying you're wrong, Christy. I'm just saying that I think there's more to it than you are saying. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but Dana, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean,
Do you want me to
it's
read the comments again? I know I got a
no,
lot.
it's okay. It's it, it just it so varies, you know. If you look at narcissism as more of like a defense mechanism where a person just really gets lost in their ego and there's this underdeveloped sense of self and low self-esteem, which tends to come across like with that well, it's either like low self-esteem or like really high self-esteem. It's not always low self-esteem. Like you have like the only example I can think of right now is if you guys are Game of Thrones fans, Joffrey, and he was a great example of kind of like the golden child narcissist. You know, just really believed he was given everything from day one, and believes that he should get his way, and it's whatever he wants, whenever he wants, as much as he wants. And he's just a little brat prince. So you get that, or you get somebody who's just, kind of kicked down, pushed around, always on the back burner, and then they kind of, become really aggressive and defensive of, well, I'll show you, kind of a thing. And then that becomes, it's anything that's really out of balance is going to be a problem. So
Yes, 100%.
I have a question. Do you want to do this last one and then
Sounds good.
call it? Okay. Luna mentions, okay, after having been through narcissistic abuse and recovering from trauma bonding, can I reclaim my empathetic sensibilities? This has been weighing heavily on me and causes me to worry. Is my worry justified?
Okay, so two things. First of all, absolutely, it happens to a lot of us when we go through this type of abuse. I even did, and I still have to watch myself sometimes. We might pick up certain fleas, as they say, behaviors, patterns, things like that. I know one of the things that I did when I was in the romantic relationship where I was dealing with a narcissist is I really did stop caring how people felt, not to the point that I did anything to hurt them, but I would feel annoyed by people who were too emotional. And this is because I had learned to shut up and not have emotions. I had numbed out in order to survive. And so, yeah, I had a hard time with that. And I still sometimes feel irritated by people who seem overly emotional to me. I'm not saying crying bothers me or anything like that. I'm saying when people have drama that isn't their drama and they want to tell me about it, and cry about it. And what I mean by that is, for example, a friend of mine, every time somebody that she knew 10 years ago has a problem, she's just crushed and broken and devastated. And she doesn't even talk to that person anymore. And I'm like, what? I feel for them too, but why are you acting like it's your problem? So anyway, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but my point is that I personally, I've had to watch myself in that way too. And I still sometimes have to remind myself, hey, don't be a jerk, be compassionate. Not that I would ever act on those negative feelings in my head, but I sometimes do feel that way and I don't want to feel negative. I always want to feel as positive as I can. So my point is, yes, I have definitely been able to bring back the empathy, especially for people in, well, in any situation. But in addition to that, I've also been able to learn how to sort of find a balance between caring too much and caring enough. Do you know what I mean? Because it used to be that I overcared about things. I cared too much, and I let things get to me too hard. And then I went through the phase where I just didn't allow myself to care. And now I kind of like to see it like this. I have this little bubble, right? And inside my bubble, there's no drama allowed in this bubble. Okay. So, but I am able to see outside of the bubble as well. And I can certainly feel for someone. I like to compassionate empathy is my favorite kind, where you can feel for someone, you can care enough to even do something to help them. And you might want to help them even if you're unable to help them, right? But you don't internalize their pain and their drama. And that is how I have evolved personally. But my point is, yes, you can get it back, but you don't want to get it back exactly the way it was because you don't want to necessarily become codependent. And the other thing I want to say about this, and then I'm going to let you talk, Dana. I'm going to let you finish. Okay, I'm going to stop. narcissist. Anyway, the other thing that I wanted to say about this is that your, wait a minute, read me the question one more time because I had a really good thing to say. What was it?
Can
Will
I
she get the
reclaim
answer?
my empathetic sensibilities?
Okay, thank you. Really quickly, the other thing I want to say is when you go through a toxic relationship, a lot of us go, I want to be who I used to be when we're done. I want to go back to who I used to be, but you can't. And it's not to say you can't be a better version of yourself or of that self. But what has happened since, between then and now is life. You may have had kids, or you may have, gotten 10 years older or 2 years older or 5 or 30, whatever. You have changed because you have had more life experiences. Now you can decide who you want to be, and you can be some version of who you used to be, but you will never be the person who you were before that time. And so instead of being sad about that, I want you to be happy and excited about that. And I want you to be focused on going forward and choosing who you are, because you can choose who you are. And what I mean is, who do you think you are? Who do you want to be? That's who you are, in my opinion. You can become your true self by asking yourself, who am I? Who do I want to be? Who do I think I am? And then moving toward that. Personally, that's what I think. Dana, thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree completely. I agree with everything you said, but I really agree with the whole, if we're going to reclaim these empathetic sensibilities, doing it within the context of healthy boundaries, standards, and deal breakers. Mm-hmm. I think so many times, so many of us, again, this stuff's not taught, like, and it's really not role modeled. So everybody's all figuring it out. Okay. That when there's a lot of us that tend to be very out of balance with empathy, and it tends to be, it tends to lead to, like what Angie was saying, that people pleasing behavior. It tends to lead to overgiving of our time, our energy, our emotions, our money, you know, all kinds of things, because we want to help so desperately. I think a lot of that tends to come from the fact that we didn't get the help that we needed. And so we're over-identifying with the struggles of others, and we're wanting them to be okay. And so that's a problem in a couple of different ways. I mean, one, it kind of cheats them out of the ability to figure things out on their own mm-hmm. and to build their esteem from doing so. And it also wears us out and gives us way too much responsibility for things that are not our responsibility. So it's important that empathy and that compassion that we're going to give to somebody else, that we also have the same amount for ourselves. So there is that balance. If we're giving compassion and empathy, but it's hurting us, then something's out of balance. And that's not a true act of compassion or empathy, because we're hurting ourselves. So that can be a good way to kind of double check to make sure that we're operating within healthy boundaries.
Yes. And,
you know, being good to yourself in the process. So.
100%. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. So many great comments here. And Peggy, you're right about that, by the way. Okay. Guys, I want to stay and talk to you all day, but unfortunately my schedule does not allow for it, nor does Dana's. Oh, thank you. Just me. They said they love my cat. Me too. He's awesome. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we will be back next week for another session like this, but over on Dana's channel, Thrive After Abuse. Here on YouTube. You can also find Dana at Thrive After Abuse around the internet, thriveafterabuse.com. And don't forget to, if you enjoy these sessions, subscribe to this channel and Dana's channel and hit the bell notification so you'll be notified when we go live together or separately, but there it is. Dana, do you have any final thoughts for today?
Actually, this is random. Normally I'll say, you guys just remember that you matter, which is true. Do that. But, you know, I think it might also, this just came to me when you said that, Angie, it would be interesting. And I would be curious if down in the comments, for those of you that feel comfortable doing so, and maybe we should start doing this on a weekly thing, because this would be interesting. I would be curious to know, what is your takeaway? What is your takeaway from the live stream today? Was there something that we discussed, or some aha moment that you had, or some question that you were left with from our conversation? And Angie and I'm just volunteering you for this, Angie. Sorry about that.
I'm good with it.
Okay. We will comb the comments and we'll pick out some of the ones, the aha moments, and then we can do that maybe in another future live stream.
I think that's a great idea. Yes, I love it. Love it. Yes. And if you have questions that we can cover, you know, put them in there.
Yeah.
I love it, Dana. Excellent. Because we're doing this for you guys. So that's great. Thank you, Dana. Great idea. We should do that every week. All right.
I agree. I would be really interested to hear. It's, you know, it's so funny because, just FYI real quick, for those in the chat, you know, Angie and I, before the start of every live stream, we kind of talk about, okay, well, what should we talk about? What do you think? And this, that, and the other. And I, you know, and then sometimes we'll talk about how a live stream went afterwards. And in people, I don't know, people probably ask you this too, Angie, like, oh, how'd your live stream today go? And I always, my response is always, I really don't know. Because what my takeaways are, or what I think is, oh man, that's such a good point. I'm so glad somebody mentioned that, or I'm so glad that we had that discussion. 9 out of 10 times, the community has different takeaways that are so different from what I would have even guessed.
And
So
that is a beautiful thing if you think about
it
it. So
absolutely is. And it helps
we hear
us
you.
to,
Yes.
yeah.
Yes. 100%. Thank you. Thank you. I love it.
Okay. Yes. Good deal.
Awesome idea. Okay. So make sure you let us know in the comments below or in the chat if you're here right now live, and let us know what is your takeaway. What do you want us to talk about next week? Share it. Let us
Yeah.
know. All right, Dana. Thank
Yeah.
you so much. And
Okay.
everyone, thank you for being here with us. We will see you next week over at Thrive After Abuse here on YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to both and hit the bell notification. We'll see you
Okay.
next time. Thanks, Dana.
Sounds good. Take care.
Oh,
Bye.
take care. Bye.